case for argument is Gray Direct versus Erie Insurance Company. Mr. Gornberg.
May it please the court, my name is Kenneth Gornberg and I represent the plaintiff appellant Gray Direct, Inc. Gray is holding a judgment against Unicom Direct, Inc. in the amount of $967,720 and also has obtained by assignment Unicom's rights against Erie Insurance Company arising under their insurance policy. And this lawsuit is Gray's lawsuit for coverage against Erie.
What was Gray's deal with United Airlines?
Gray was managing their flight.
Yes, I know. Why is it that the liability comes to rest on Gray?
Because of the fact that Gray was managing the program.
No, there's a contract, right?
Yes, and frankly, Your Honor, I don't know the terms of the contract because we have a judgment, and as we've gotten into this case.
That's very odd. Why is it you think Gray is liable rather than United Airlines? United Airlines issues the tickets.
Oh, yes, Your Honor, but United then made the claim against Gray for.
Yes, so what was that based on? Contract, tort, what have you?
I believe it was based on contract, Your Honor, but I do not know that for a fact. I believe it was based on contract.
Odd, you think that would be the first question. And what are the damages based on?
That, as I understand it, is based on the cost to United of honoring these additional certificates.
Now, by cost, do you mean the retail price of the tickets or the marginal cost of United Airlines or what?
I don't know what proof United presented to Gray. This was all, as I said, because of the way this case unfolded, we never really explored these issues. They never really came out.
It comes out to something like $162 mm-hmm. per flight, which is a lot for a United cost base,
right.
At least. I mean, you can actually buy in the market flights to this day for that if you're a savvy shopper. So,
if you have empty seats,
yeah,
the marginal cost, they don't feed their coach passengers anymore, so it's pretty negligible.
I understand everything that the court is saying, and quite honestly, again, I do not know. All of this was, as far as we can tell, well past decided.
But let me ask you, you paid something like, what, $63 or something like that, and trying to recover $900,000 or a million, which would be a very good contract. But what is the prejudice? I mean, yes, Erie didn't handle this very well. Their employee was confused. What was the prejudice to you? How could you have somehow recovered that $900,000 some other way if Erie hadn't bobbled the paperwork?
I don't say that there is any prejudice to my client, Gray, and I don't know that.
Why should we give you this gigantic windfall?
Your Honor, it's
why would the law be like that? Why would the law do that? What's that sense? People make mistakes, and if it imposes costs on other people, then they have to pay. But if they don't pay costs on other people, we don't usually think that the proper penalty for a mistake that doesn't hurt anybody is $1 million, right? What sense does that make?
Again, we're at two levels here because we're talking about right now I'm representing Gray, but I'm also standing in the shoes of Unicom, which incurred a nearly $1 million judgment. It has a right to turn to its insurance policy.
Yeah, but why did it... Yes, it was you who screwed up, and you've held United harmless. You were the ones who made the mistake. Erie didn't contribute to this loss, obviously.
And Your Honor, it was actually Unicom that made the mistake. Unicom
well, whoever
doing the
made
job
the
for
mistake.
Gray.
Erie didn't make a mistake that caused the loss. All Erie did was mishandle its paperwork to give you some kind of technical argument that you're insured when you're obviously not and should have known that. No one gets to buy insurance after the catastrophe has occurred. Certainly don't buy for $63 a known loss of $900,000.
Your Honor, I think there are circumstances where insurance can be purchased after the fact.
But not at those terms. Not when you have a certain loss that's huge and a premium of that is minute. I mean, you could have a probable loss and you could pay a very stiff premium, or you could be paying for the legal expenses, but not this kind of windfall.
And Erie knew all of this when it issued the document.
Yes, I know, but what social purpose would be served by your recovering from Erie?
The social purpose, Your Honor, would be to make sure that insurance companies are more careful in the way that they deal with their
policyholders. We don't want anybody to be more careful than is commensurate with the losses that carelessness imposes, right? You don't want to say, do you, that because we want insurance companies to be careful, we should have taken and shot this employee who made the mistake. Because if we did that, the insurance companies would be much more careful.
Isn't there
such a thing as taking too much care because because the punishment greatly exceeds the crime?
The punishment here, Your Honor, is exactly what would be provided under the policy they amended it.
But the problem is there's no evidence. I mean, aside from the over-deterrence point that Judge Posner's making, there's absolutely no evidence that Erie went through the procedures it would go through for a retroactive amendment to the policy to cover a loss that has already taken place. One administrative person doing a computer printout isn't the way Erie handles its underwriting, or at least there's no evidence that it suddenly adopted some new procedure for its underwriting. I mean, I just don't see where the agreement exists to have retroactive coverage here.
Your Honor, the company, Erie as a company, knew everything that it needed to know
but
to
it
make
does,
that decision.
Erie as a company, though, went through a set of procedures back in August to enter into this insurance contract to begin with Unicom. And it has to be your position that it chose not to use those procedures, that somehow there was a completely different way of deciding for $63 to pay out a surefire $1 million. It seems impossible to me.
Your Honor, again, what we're now getting into, I believe, would be issues of fact.
No, it's not an issue of fact. There's no debate whatsoever that this additional coverage was not added until October. I mean, that's absolutely clear. The only thing that you're talking about is even though it wasn't added until October and even though the premium was prorated, somehow or another in January when poor old Ms. Kuski, whatever her name was.
Mazinski, Your Honor.
Mazinski. Printed it out the wrong way, suddenly the whole underwriting department of Erie had made a decision. But there's no evidence that anybody with responsibility for underwriting was involved in this.
I grant that, Your Honor. And again, my position is that this is a company. It's not one department versus another department.
Well, but yours is a company, too. And if you've got, in a sense, a confession on the part of the owner of your company that she knew she didn't get that insurance until October and that the effective date was October, as it clearly was in the initial policy, then it seems to me that shows there's no meeting of the minds, if you will.
I don't think there is that confession, Your Honor, because I think her testimony actually was that she was confused. She did not understand what she already had received in October, and that was precisely why she asked for additional materials in January.
Okay, suppose the day after this, what you think was retroactive coverage, was issued, the company, Erie, had discovered its mistake and had said to you, oh, you know, we made this terrible mistake, we didn't mean to do this, and you said, tough luck. And suppose Erie then brought a suit to rescind the insurance coverage on the ground that it had been a mistake. What would be the outcome of such a suit?
I think that would be a very different case than we have here today, Your Honor.
Oh, I could be identical.
And
who moves first? Does the person who made the mistake move for rescission first? Does the person who wants to take advantage of the mistake sue to secure his windfall first? Would that make a difference?
Your Honor, the difference is not just who moves first. It's timing and knowledge. Erie knew about this and has known about this for...
Why would it make a... I know, but why would it make a difference?
Because, in effect, Erie has allowed, with its knowledge, it has not done any of those things that
you
just said.
Well, why has that hurt you, that they didn't... Because they didn't sue for rescission first?
I do not believe that it matters whether I've been hurt. It matters what happens as a result of
if
contract
If it doesn't
law.
Matter whether you're hurt, then that rescission suit should fail, right? Why would a rescission for mistake ever succeed if it doesn't matter whether the mistake harms anybody? What would be the basis for rescission?
Then we're asking now what Erie is going to do, and I don't know what Erie wants to
no,
do.
No, no. I'm asking what a court would do if Erie had sought rescission on the basis of mistake.
If they had sought that immediately upon learning about it in January, I believe that a court most likely would have granted that rescission.
And how would the court have reasoned to that result?
The court would have concluded that, as Ms. Marzynski ultimately testified, based on all of the evidence that Erie would have been able to present, most likely they would have concluded, a court most likely would conclude, or a jury could conclude, if they disregard the evidence that I have, that this was not intentional, they did not choose to extend this coverage, and that therefore rescission should be allowed. If Erie had done that immediately upon learning all of this, I think we would have a very different circumstance than we have here, where they allowed everything to go by and never said a word about it.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Gorenberg. Mr. Brannett?
Brenner, the starting point for this appeal is the essential concession on their part.
Yes, we know about it. You don't have to repeat what's been said.
Well, it's that this is a known loss. There's no dispute about that. The only question is whether Gray Direct can throw up roadblocks to prevent application of that doctrine and therefore finding, as the district court held, that there is no duty to defend or indemnify. The first roadblock they try to throw up is the doctrine of estoppel. But that does not apply if there's no duty to defend. And there's no duty to defend when, if you look at the complaint and compare it to the policy, there's clearly no coverage.
Well, it seems to me that the strongest argument I can think of from the Gray Direct point of view is, first of all, Erie is a single company, and it's really not the insured's problem to figure out which department is doing what and who's talking to whom or how frequently, and that it is possible for parties to contract for retroactive coverage of a known loss, even though it may seem economically absurd to promise to pay $1 million in exchange for 63, and maybe that's so absurd that on its face we just couldn't go there, but one can, in principle, contract retroactively to cover a known loss. And so their argument is that that's what the company, Erie, did when it issued this January document showing the effective date of August.
If this was a contractual document, there may be some argument. If it could get over the hurdle of the $63 to pay $1 million, it's actually $54 because it was prorated.
Whatever.
But in any event, this is not a contract. This was not a contractual document. There was no request by the insurer to change coverage. She requested a copy of the policy, not a change in the policy. We endeavored to provide her with a copy of the policy. In doing so,
why doesn't the policy, though, reflect the contract between the insurance company and the insured? So she gets a copy of the policy, and it says it has printer's errors and omissions coverage from August forward. Why can't she say, well, that must be the contract I have with the company now?
Well, because there's two reasons. The primary one one of them is factual. She testified in her depositions that she was requesting a copy so that she could compare it to the original that she had. So she knew what she had. This isn't a question that she was misled somehow by this document. She knew exactly what the policy said. So when she got this January 8, 2004 document and she compared it, as she said she did, she saw herself that there was a mistake on there. So there was no misleading here. There was no deception or any reasonable reliance on her part that this is an accurate copy of the policy. She knew it wasn't. Second, a legal argument is that there's no meeting of the minds here. There's no intent on anybody's part that this is changing the policy. This isn't a question of constructive notice. Should we have known?
Well, you're saying it's a mutual mistake. Neither of them thought that the policy was being amended. Isn't that what you're saying?
That would be a way of putting it. But that what that means is that it's reformed to its original, which is that it was October 15th was the effective date. In other words, this was a mutual mistake on both parts. A mutual mistake cannot create a contract to begin with, nor can it create a modification of the contract. A mutual mistake at that point means there is no contract. There's no meeting of the minds at all. Not only that, there was no consideration given here for a change in the policy. Now, all these things are undisputed by them. There's complete silence on their part to our arguments. There was no offer, no acceptance, no consideration. So that January 8, 2004 document that we sent out with the typographical error on it is not a contract. It's not a legally binding document. Could they have argued there was some estoppel here? I doubt it, but they didn't even try. So that's not an issue. So there's no source of contractual duty based on that January 8th document, and there's no source of duty on equity either.
Mr. Brandon, I just have to ask you whether Rebecca Merzinski still works for Erie.
She does. As far as I know, she does, Your Honor, yes.
Well, I guess you'll never make that mistake again.
So the January 8th, 2004 document does not create any obligations on the part of Erie. It was a simple mistake. It created no duties. So we go back to the other roadblocks that they've tried to create. Again, the first is estoppel. But that we have pointed out and argued and established that on the face of the complaint, their own complaints against Unicom and ComDirect, that complaint itself establishes that this was a known loss. Again, complete silence on their part in response to that. So that's a conceded finding that this is, on its face, shows a known loss. Well, Illinois law is clear that when you compare the face of the complaint and the policy and you find there's no coverage, there's no duty to defend, no
estoppel.
Well,
but you assume, I mean, as I said before, it's not legally impossible to cover a known loss. It's just really, really unlikely that anybody decided to do that.
That's correct.
So the face of the, I mean, I don't want to go too far with the face of the complaint.
Well, the real question, as you're pointing out, is which is the policy do you compare it to? The face of the complaint definitely shows a known loss. Then you ask, what policy do you compare that to? And we've established that it's the October 15th policy, not this document that went out on January 8th. That's not a legal document. It doesn't create any estoppel or equitable rights.
I think you're on stronger grounds with equitable rights, for sure, because if we really move over into the world of equity, this certainly looks like a windfall that Gray Direct is asking for.
It definitely would be a windfall, Your Honor.
That it, or you have something more?
No, well, the second roadblocks they try to throw up are waiver. Again, we've made arguments that they have not responded to, that we're not required to put all of that into the declination letter. I don't think it's worth getting into the whole federal rules of pleading issues. So it really boils down to that last issue, which is the policy? What are the policy? There's no evidence. Again, this is a crucial point. There's no evidence of any intent by Erie to cover this known loss. Throughout this whole thing, we have denied coverage for it. It would be absurd to say that we somehow intended to cover the known loss because we made a mistake. Intent is intentional. It's not mistaken.
Okay.
Thank
well, thank you, Mr. Brandon. Mr. Gornberg, your time had expired, but you can have a minute if you have some wish to.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. I will try to be very, very brief. The first thing I want to say is that Mr. Brannett made some representations about testimony from Unicom's owner about comparing what she already had and seeing the mistake. There is nothing in the record that says that. It is directly contrary to the record, in fact. The other thing that I will point out is that when he talks about what you have to look at it, in looking at the policy under determining the duty to defend, Illinois law is clear that both the allegations and policy must be construed, if there's any doubt, in favor of coverage, in favor of the insured. This document is out there. This January 8th, 2004 document is out there, which, for all appearances, it looks like a duck, it quacks like a duck. That's an amendment to the policy.
Is that presumption favor of coverage? That doesn't make any sense unless, you know, you were somehow discouraged from shopping for other insurance against this lawsuit incurred. And you don't argue that, right?
Well, Your Honor, we're just looking at the time of Erie making its decision about whether it's going to honor its duty to defend, and it has to look at the documents that it is issued.
There's a reason for a presumption of coverage, and it doesn't apply here.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't hear.
There's a reason for having a presumption of coverage, but it doesn't apply here. It's connected with the lack of prejudice, with the windfall element of your case.
Oh, Your Honor, I will grant that it is certainly a rebuttable presumption, and they are entitled to attempt to rebut it, which is what I think they're trying to do in this case.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Gorenberg.
Thank you very much.
Move on. Thank you to both counsel.